From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining me for this year-end special edition. It's been quite a year. The WHQR Newsroom has covered a lot of stories, and it's almost overwhelming to look back at everything that happened this year. At times, it's been challenging, confounding, sometimes inspiring, and yeah, occasionally heartbreaking. But this has been really and truly rewarding work. I could not have asked for a better team with whom to go through it all. But I don't want you to take my word for it. On today's show, you'll have a chance to hear the highlights from my colleagues themselves, Rachel Keith, Aaliyah McConnell, Kelly Kinnear, and Nikolai Mather. First up, to recap her year, is Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So you did spend a lot of time this year covering the New Hanover County School District, and there was a lot to cover. So break down some of what you saw from your perch as a journalist this year.
Well, one of the biggest stories of the year was the firing of the former superintendent, Dr. Charles Faust. That was done late at night in July. And basically what precipitated that was a pretty damning climate survey from the district. And when they unveiled those results, he was, you know, fired shortly after that. There was significant pushback against some of the board's policies. And so that climate survey this year also said that they needed to recalibrate the way that they were leading the school district. And then now we have Dr. Christopher Barnes, who was the head of HR, stepping into the interim role. They named Dr. Barnes the interim that night. And, you know, so far, there's been praise on both sides of the aisle for his leadership. He's going to be in office until at least July 1, but they're going to be deciding whether or not to do a search firm for his replacement, or we'll see if he remains after July 1. And when we talk about Dr. Faust, we know that we had a very contentious budget cycle this year. They had to get rid of positions through attrition or retirement, over 200. So it was a huge issue. People came out from the community to say to stop these cuts. But they had to make tough calls because they were facing a $20 million budget shortfall. So, and even it took three votes to pass this year's budget because the board members were saying they weren't getting the information that they needed from Dr. Faust.
I think the board members, both the current and the board members who are rolling on, have been pretty, you know, they've towed the line pretty well. There are legal restrictions about what they can say about the process of firing Faust. But we do know that there was frustration about the budget. And we do know there was frustration about sort of staff morale and the climate. And we know that's something that interim Superintendent Barnes has spent a lot of time already kind of working at. But there are other kind of major problems that the school district has to deal with. And, you know, infrastructure comes to mind, specifically New Hanover High School. We spent a lot of time and you did some in-depth reporting on just how significant the needs for that school are.
Yes, New Hanover High School came to a crisis point. It was interesting. I did a report in May, and they had planned these new updates, but then they had to scrap all of those to basically take care of an emergency situation where they had to close 16 different classrooms. And for this report I did in May, I interviewed a student, a former New Hanover High student named Samaj Moore, and he was talking about, and he is a former student athlete there, and he was just talking about how the school has been ignored.
When we have away games to go into Hoggard or Laney, like, and just seeing their facilities, their locker rooms, their fields, just everything just compared to ours at New Hanover was just better. And I don't know how to explain the feeling, but it just like kind of felt like they didn't really care about how our facilities look because it's been so long since they've been like updated or anything.
And there he's talking about they. I think he's just talking about the people in charge not making New Hanover a priority. And again, because of all these issues, these foundational issues that have been found this year, they've had to fund a $300,000 master plan study, which would look at the entire school and how they could update it. Then you have several millions of dollars to start some of these phases because, again, they had to buy trailers for some of the students to go into, and that they are working on reestablishing these 16 classrooms, but they're saying that the infrastructure improvements that are happening now, I mean, that won't be open. They are hoping until this upcoming school year, this, you know, fall of 2025. So that was a really big story that kind of blew open, and people are reacting to it. They are trying to solve the issue.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not to, you know, quote unquote, save the school or build a new one. Both of those provide some pretty significant challenges. I'm not saying which way they'll go, but I know we are talking about something in the high eight figures, possibly even nine figures. This is a big project, which has had a lot of people wondering whether or not they will see that or that and something else on a school bond.
That's right. And that's been another conversation that's been missing. And now it seems like the county commission and the school board are going to be working on that school bond ask coming up in the next year or so. And I talked to Assistant Superintendent Eddie Anderson, and he is saying that it's going to be at least $100 million. So where are they going to come up for that? And that's the rehab, or a whole new school would be, you know, $150 million. So, and then you have to talk about land, you know, as well. If they're going to go that route.
Yeah, and that's a tricky issue, but that's not even all that they're still facing. They're still, you know, facing questions about enrollment and discipline. We don't know if we're going to see more rounds of questioning books that are in the schools, whether that's banning them or keeping them out of certain classrooms. And of course, we still have sort of the lingering question about the impact of the educational opportunity scholarships, the private school voucher program.
Yes, that's right. And yeah, I mean, in 2023, the big story was, you know, stamped anti-racism, racism, and you being removed. And then this past year, we had the controversial policies surrounding, you know, classroom displays and then how teachers are supposed to conduct themselves in the classroom. And then, yes, on top of that, there's talking about school funding. And it was in October that I visited Hoggard High. Those teachers and staff basically came together to show their support for the legislature to send a lot of money to help rebuild those schools in the wake of Hurricane Helene. And they also said this is not the time to fund the voucher system, which what you talked about, the opportunity scholarships, giving families money to send their children to religious or private schools. And here is Ed Turgeon. He's a Hoggard teacher.
So what you end up with is people that have enough money already to send their kids to private school, just taking advantage of, you know, a tax system that's just giving them a little bit of extra money that they probably don't need to begin with.
So the legislature decided to remove the cap for families making a certain amount of money. So anybody can apply for these scholarships, and they're anywhere from $3,000 to $7,000 right now.
Yeah, so that's definitely a story we'll have to follow, including what happens to this reserve fund that the program is supposed to be creating. But I know that's something you'll be watching next year. I do want to pivot to Cape Fear Community College, because you spent even more time covering them. I don't know how all of this time comes out of one human being, but you've managed to do it. So tell me a little bit about what you've covered there this year.
Yeah, so a large loss for the students of the Marine Technology Program was the longtime veteran loss of their leader, Jason Rogers. And so they were very upset. They never got answers as to why he was removed from his position as chair, and he couldn't even teach in the program. He's just a regular biology instructor right now. And actually, when they came to one of these trustee meetings in July, they were basically asking questions about the future of their program and the future of the Cape Hatteras, an aging ship that needs to be replaced. They were barred from the meeting. And I asked, could you at least send one of them in? And they said no. So I've been covering that. And then we also have people continuing to go on the record saying that there's an alleged toxic work environment. And this was from a longtime mathematics instructor, and he was the chair right when he retired. And the board wanted to recognize him for his years of service to the college, but he said no. And his name is Keenan Jones, and I interviewed him in April.
I knew that they were going to do a little dog and pony show. Look, my pride is how I've changed lives. The board should be ashamed of themselves, in my opinion. It's just let's hold some accountability. And that's part of the reason I didn't want to show up and have some kind of recognition. I can't look them in the eye with what I've seen going on in the last 5 years or so.
And some of those things are that CFCC was placed on an accreditation warning, something that they haven't had in a long time, in December of 2023, and they spent all year on that warning. But they did come off of that just this month. So that was announced, and I did some reporting on that. And then I've reported on the past of people continuing to be walked out of their offices before, you know, their retirement is up or their contracts are up.
And this is, for people who aren't familiar, there's literally like a law enforcement officer or security personnel like comes to your office and walks you out like you're being kicked out of the NSA or the FBI.
Yes. And Keenan was saying that's what he's saying that was very hurtful because these were longtime employees just like him that he thinks in his point of view didn't do anything wrong. But then we have the Board of Trustees giving Jim Morton a $25,000 bonus this year and that he makes over $400,000. Another significant raise that he's had, and I've covered his raise progression over the past 4 years. So the board thinks that everything is fine, but people continue to come forward to say that they are not fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I could take a hazard at summing up your reporting over the last couple of years, it's that when we talk to the Marine Tech students or we talk to, you know, faculty or staff who are, you know, sort of frustrated, they describe a community college that they care a lot about, but that has some real issues.
Absolutely.
And when we hear from President Jim Morton, we hear everything is hunky-dory, we're excelling, firing on all pistons, that kind of thing. And so there just seems to be a clash of opinions there. But the Board of Trustees clearly has voiced, at least a majority of the Board of Trustees has voiced their support for Jim and then put their money where their mouth is.
Yes, absolutely. And the lawsuit is ongoing, Ray Funderburk's lawsuit against the Board of Trustees. And that was when he was removed from his position during a hearing. And so that lawsuit's ongoing. So I'll be continuing to follow that in the new year.
And Ray Funderburk, one of the probably the only trustee we've seen ask any questions about raises for Morton, but questions more broadly, too, about how the college is operating. So however that lawsuit turns out, I know you'll be following it. So
that's right.
A lot of stories set for 2025. Before I let you go, I just want to ask, you know, I know that you spend, as I've said repeatedly, a lot of time covering education, whether that's the school district or our community college system. But I know you have other interests, so give people a little taste of other stuff you might be looking at next year.
Yes, I do like to follow scientific breakthroughs that our local researchers from UNCW are doing here. And I've done some of those stories this year, and I hope to continue. Some of them are kind of sad. You know, we have the Marine Mammal Stranding Program. Scientists who have responded to right whales who have died, harbor seals, again, washing up on the shore. And this year, I just covered manatees for the first time, that this manatee was hit by a boat and then cold stunned. But then there are exciting stories in our state that one was saved this year. A team from Florida came up and captured the one in the Tar River and brought it back down south. So if scientists know about, you know, some of these animals and issues, they can get out ahead of it and save some lives. It's exciting.
That is exciting. All right. Well, Rachel Keith, thank you for being here and Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
Up next is the newest addition to the WHQR News team, Aaliyah McConnell, who joined us this summer to cover the criminal justice system. Aaliyah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. So you joined us over the summer, but you've already put a lot of work into this community covering the criminal justice system. So I want to ask you what you thought some of your highlights were.
Yeah, so definitely one of the highlights of covering the community and criminal justice within the community, I have to say, is doing the story on restorative justice that involved Thorny Cooper. This was one of the first pieces that I worked on for WHQR. I got to work with Kelly on this story. And admittedly, I was pretty nervous moving, you know, just in addition to moving to a new state and reporting on a beat that was new to me. But I found it really beneficial to team up with her because she demonstrated, you know, how to identify stories that this community does care about. And then, you know, just the logistics of it, you know, setting up time to visit an inmate in a prison and talking to people about very traumatic experiences that they've had. But yeah, so we were granted access into the Sampson Correctional Facility. We met with Thorny Cooper, who was arrested about 25 years ago for shooting a man named Andre Watkins. But ultimately, Thorny Cooper's story is one of redemption, and that's why we wanted to highlight restorative justice in how it can be beneficial to society as a whole.
Now, this is a story that for some people on paper might even be hard to believe because, you know, we're talking about forgiving someone for, you know, some of the most serious crimes that you can be incarcerated for.
Yes. And it's not only unbelievable for listeners, but the people that are involved in those cases as well. So even speaking with Thorny Cooper, he actually was given forgiveness from the victim's family. He said that they, you know, that it really touched him. And it was something that he never imagined would happen. But through this program, he did get that opportunity. And it gives people closure on, you know, both ends after a crime has been committed. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's an impressive piece of reporting. I'm glad you got to team up with Kelly because there was a lot of work that went into that.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, we'll have links to that on the page. If people missed that, I encourage them to go check it out.
For sure.
this was a tough story, I know, because you were coming in at the end of the story of the Wilmington dentist who was arrested on numerous charges of assaulting his patients. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, so I covered the Michael Hasson case. Actually, it's the best of, you know, the two pronunciations. So there's Hasson, there's Hasson, it's actually Hasson. So, you know, it really, I think the case sparked a lot of conversations over, you know, sexual assault and power imbalances and the overall trust that we put into our medical professionals. It really, you know, affected a lot of people. You know, the victims, they testified and told their stories and talked about what happened. And ultimately, that is what brought justice at the end of the day. And, you know, other evidence, like one of the women who testified, they actually had video evidence, which, you know, ended up being really pivotal in that case and, you know, proving that he was actually, you know, going under the operating blankets and, you know, doing things while the women were unconscious.
Because she had, like, left her phone on, like, in airplane mode, but, like, recording video because she kind of had some suspicions.
Yeah.
I know a big part of the story was just how long it took. I mean, the arrest happened in 2019, as I recall, before the pandemic, so like in the before times. And so there were delays because of the pandemic. There were delays because the defendant changed lawyers at one point. And just the criminal justice system does take a long time and is often very difficult for victims, obviously, but for the public in general to understand, like, what is going on? Why is it taking so long? Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, despite all of that, and as frustrating as all that obviously was, you know, these women finally getting a chance to testify and to see, you know, this guy put away. It's not a life sentence, but it's kind of like an effective life sentence.
Right. And I think one of the things that I appreciated the most of covering the case was getting to see the women, you know, speak out. You know, once the guilty verdict was delivered, they were able to express to Hasson while he was there, like to his face, but, you know, not directly. He wasn't, of course, looking them in the eye at any point, but they were able to express how he had impacted their lives. And it was really a touching moment. And in a way, it kind of was a form of restorative justice, but not really, because Hasson, he wasn't really an active participant in it. But it was good that they got to say their piece before he was taken into custody. And I'm glad that I got to witness that.
I've covered a few sexual assault cases where the survivor finally gets that chance. And you're right. It isn't the full restorative justice where you get to engage with the other person and maybe even get some questions answered. But to be able to say it on the record, you know, in front of a judge and the people in the courtroom, and I think that does serve like a pretty significant purpose. I want to move on to another story you covered. This was not as complicated, but like it definitely touched a lot of people. And this was the story of the missing trailer. What was going on with this?
Yes. So the trailer was stolen. Stolen shower trailer that belonged to the warming shelter. I talked with Pastor Meg McBride about that. And it was, you know, a tough thing that happened to the community. And seeing other news outlets that reported on it, they kind of just covered, you know, the facts of the case. You know, the trailer truck was missing and what time it went missing and all that kind of stuff. But when I was talking with McBride, I really saw it as an opportunity to highlight the community's resilience and the goodwill of people. So it was like, you know, everyone said, okay, we lost this vital resource, which isn't ideal, but how can we step up to the plate and do what we have to do? So I enjoyed putting, you know, a more positive spin on that event. And, you know, I feel like sometimes that kind of highlights the job of public radio to dive deeper into a story and capture the humanity of people.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, I definitely saw a couple of quick news hits that was just, you know, like any other property crime story. And I think it missed a little bit of like what this actually was. Like if you've ever had to go for whatever reason, like a couple days without showering, I was stuck in the airport once for 2 days.
Yeah.
And that shower. Oh, my God. And that's a fraction of what people who are like living rough on the streets are experiencing.
Right.
Like there's a monumental benefit for them. So not only did they lose that, but this is like a small group of largely volunteered, under-resourced, underfunded. And so for them to take a hit like that and then to bounce back, like that's really impressive.
Yeah.
I think you did capture that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the year is almost over. You've got some stuff in the pipeline that you are working on. I've seen you over there at your desk working on it. Tell us what you have in store for 2025.
Yeah. So for 2025... I did one story on Cassie Payton. So for those of just as a refresher, Cassie Payton never got to bring charges upon the people who sexually assaulted her. But instead of, you know, focusing on that, she took matters into her own hands. She started investigating into her own case, but it was never prosecuted. But because of that, it kind of made her question the system and call for these reforms. So she created a petition, and now the petition has, you know, close to 4,000 signatures now, but just basic reforms, calling on a mandatory 48-hour response time, and for law enforcement to kind of just keep in contact and kind of give updates on what they've done so far. Just so, you know, a victim isn't left in limbo wondering what happened or what's happening with their case. So I'll be working on a more in-depth series on Cassie's story, talking about how her assault sort of catapulted her into this role as a de facto community activist, and letting her story set the stage to talk about the overall issue of sexual assault and the cracks within our criminal justice system that fails victims time and time again.
Yeah, and I will say your reporting kicked off a slew of other coverage, both of the story and of the protest that she held at the Wilmington Police Department. Port City Daily, WCT has done some coverage. And like that to me is like the heart of good reporting. It's like if you're drawing attention to the issue and getting other people, like a scoop is great, but like you want the whole community to talk about it. And I think your reporting had that effect, which is good because it's going to take a lot of effort to change how the police.
Yeah.
Like they're very set in their ways, and that's part of the problem. I think there are people who... You know, I think there are people in the community who are fine with the idea of the police department. They're fine with the extraordinary amount of resources that we give them. You know, the largest chunk of any municipal budget is usually public safety. But that if to whom much is given, much is asked, right?
Right.
So we're asking them to do a better job of this.
Right. And people think because these resources are being poured into our law enforcement agencies that, you know, if the worst ever happens – that it'll work out in this idealistic way, you know, they'll do all their due diligence and then justice will be served. And a lot of times that's just not how the law system works.
You won't have that 42-minute Law and Order arc where it's like they find the dead body in the cold open and then they've solved the case and convicted the criminal by the end of the show.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. But speaking of how police, I am also working on a podcast that kind of covers that. So it's going to be called The Citizens Debrief. It's going to chronicle my participation in the New Hanover County Sheriff's Citizens Academy. But I think our audience would be really surprised to find out, you know, the complete extent of the services that the sheriff's office in particular provides. And hopefully that'll help our listeners and people in the community and in general have a better understanding of how certain processes within the criminal justice system work.
I am really looking forward to this because one of the biggest things I've run up against in reporting on criminal justice system is that once you get into it, you get pretty in the weeds and you start becoming an expert and you're talking to people as if they are also experts. And often they're like, they have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I think this will be a great resource for people. I really look forward to it. So, but you got to wait for next year.
I can't wait for next year.
Okay. Yes. Well, for now, Leah, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Ben.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be back with more from the WHQR newsroom, hearing from my colleagues Kelly Kinoyer and Nikolai Mather. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm here now with my colleague Kelly Kinoyer, who's joining us to recap her year at WHQR. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we were talking off mics before we started recording this. You thought you had done basically nothing this year, but it turns out you've done a lot.
Yes, it turns out that I started the year with a major project that took me 6 months to put out, and then I continued doing extremely large projects throughout the year and then forgetting about them.
You almost projected yourself to death, but you're still alive. So what was this first big project?
Okay, so the first big project that I did was this story about how the justice system interacts with homeless individuals in the Cape Fear region. So I went into the community court system, I interviewed judges, I talked to police, I followed police teams around as they went to different homeless encampments, and I really saw all of the different places where the justice system helps and hurts homeless people in our community. And my one qualm about that newsroom episode that I put out is that I didn't actually get to put a face to those stories. I didn't get to interview any homeless people and put them on the air, especially around crime. It's a little bit touchy. And I kind of fixed that problem later with my in-depth reporting on what it's like to be homeless in the Cape Fear region, which was a series I did with Maddie Gray later this year, too.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that a little bit because you guys spent a lot of time and energy, and we actually had a segment explaining sort of how that all played out. But for people who don't remember, this is photojournalist Maddie Gray. This is a project partially funded by the Fourth Estate Fund. But for me, the most impressive thing was just the effort that went in that will never show up, doesn't show up in the photos directly. It doesn't show up in the reporting directly, but you can kind of feel it because there's this intimacy to the reporting.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that made this possible, this series that we did, is that I have developed very good, close relationships with people involved in housing advocacy and especially in helping homeless people on the ground in the Cape Fear region over the course of my time here as a reporter. So I know that I can go to Pastor Jamie or I can go to Pastor Meg McBride and say, do you have anybody who would be helpful for me to talk to? There are other sources I won't even name who will talk to me on background and tell me, hey, this individual has an incredible story and I told him he should talk to you. And so I've been able to develop trust because these are folks who are really vulnerable. They're afraid to share their stories a lot of the time. But if somebody they trust says you can trust her too, that means that I have this in and it makes it a lot easier. And so I was able to build that rapport really quickly with folks who are really vulnerable.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make you blush, but I have had people ask, how the hell did they pull that off?
Really?
Yeah, I tell them, like, this is a masterclass in sourcing.
Yeah, and it's not like I had these folks who the profiles were as my sources. It was the people who we mutually knew and who respected both of us. And I think that's part of it, too, is treating the folks who are unhoused like people is something that's hard for a lot of Americans to do for some reason. We create this distance through dehumanization with people who are unhoused when it could literally be any of us with an unlucky turn. And I think that keeping that in the back of your mind can kind of help create a little bit more rapport than they might get with somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was my hope as an editor when I first talked to you and Maddie and you guys were brainstorming the project. It is easier to sort of debate the fate of people when they are abstract policy points. Much harder to do when they're as you said, human beings.
Yeah. And honestly, I think it's worth noting, too, we do kind of have ongoing relationships with some of the folks profiled. Teresa Shively and her family were one of the most poignant stories in that series. And she has continued to volunteer for WHQR as a station because she's grateful that we were willing to tell her story on the air. She just thinks that having her story out there, being recognized in the community, was really important for her. And she feels seen in a way that she didn't before when her and her family were living in tents in the woods. And now they're in an apartment, and I'm so thrilled to see that. I don't think that's the case for all of the other folks we profiled. I know Cindy made it in. But the other three, I think they're still working on it. And that means we have more reporting to do.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, one of the things we've talked about in the newsroom is always trying to bring this back into the bigger conversation about housing, because it's not like homelessness is this island issue off to the side that is unrelated to someone maybe in our tax bracket struggle with affordable housing. And it's all part of one system. And I think that idea is starting to take root, because when I talk to people in the public who followed your reporting on housing and homelessness, they understand that the market forces that are pushing people into low-income housing or onto the street aren't divorced completely from what's making it hard to find an affordable apartment for, say, a teacher or a cop.
Yeah. I mean, housing is a spectrum. Affordability is a spectrum. And we know that 53% of the residents in this county struggle to afford their housing. They're housing burdened, which means they're vulnerable to having the same problem happen to them because they can't quite make ends meet. And that's just a reality in this community. And that's why I always try and draw those parallels between the housing market and homelessness. It's a spectrum.
Yeah. And I want to use this as an opportunity to pivot, because you've also looked at some of the pushback against development. Economics 101 tell us that more units in our region will drive down prices. It's supply and demand. I know it's more complicated than that. But whenever a developer comes along and tries to build something, we see pushback. And there's lots of different reasons for that. But you also covered how development actually happens, because when people go to protest, say, a new mixed-use 300-unit apartment complex in their backyard, they often don't understand what's actually happening at the government level.
Right. You know, I was covering some contentious developments that were planned to go up. There was one on Oleander that developer Dave Petrino was trying to get past, and it was extremely controversial. I think over 100 people showed up to that planning hearing, and then the same number or even more people showed up to the council vote. It did go through, but before all of that was happening, as I was continuing to report on it, we would get questions from residents. How can this be happening? Why is the meeting happening this way? And why didn't we hear about this sooner? Why is it just signs being put up? So I figured there was just a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding. And so I created a series called Development 101, kind of explaining step by step how development works in the Cape Fear region, both in terms of timeline and here's an issue you're worried about. Let's talk about tree preservation. Let's talk about traffic. If you want to be involved in discussing the future of development in this community, this is what your say might look like, with whether it's one particular development or maybe putting your opinion into the comprehensive plan. So that was a valuable resource, just because it makes it really easy for me to send one link to a concerned citizen who questions something. And I'm glad that I was able to create that valuable resource for the community.
Yeah, I also felt like it was a good opportunity for us to be able to kind of respond to some of the criticisms we got from readers and listeners who felt like we were covering things without touching on the pushback. So this gave, look, if you don't understand what's happening, here it is. And I think, you know, a lot of reporters will sometimes get really deep into their beat and understand it almost too well and start writing at a sort of an expert level. And people like me will read it and be like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I really had to learn those lessons the hard way when I was a young reporter. Luckily, I did that before I moved to Wilmington. So I hope that my reporting is still not too in the weeds most of the time. So the city of Wilmington recently agreed to a bid for the sale of a property on Chestnut and 3rd Street. And as part of this bid process, they said that they would restrict it to be a grocery store if it's developed in the next 10 years. That's what Cape Fear Commercial, which was the agency behind the bid, said that they would do. And a lot of people online were saying, I can't believe we didn't get a public hearing about this possible grocery store downtown. But it wasn't a zoning hearing. It had nothing to do with zoning. It actually doesn't have to do with development. It was the sale of land. There's never public hearings associated with those kind of bidding processes. So it was a misunderstanding in the general public public and people were feeling like they were left out of the conversation when this was just a bid. And whatever ends up being developed later, they actually will have to go through that process unless it's by right, which I think it might be. I think it might be UMX and pretty much anything can go there.
You can do a lot in that central business area in downtown Wilmington.
Yeah. So that was a classic example of people not quite understanding the way these processes do work. And that's part of the reason I wanted to have kind of just an educational, here's how this works series to explain. Yeah, I mean, it's a rezoning. That's when you get the chance to give your comments in a public hearing, is during a rezoning.
Right. So it's not always us just sending a one-directional message to our listeners and readers. You also spent a lot of time this year listening to what people had to say. Again.
Yes. Last year, we did the community agenda. This year, we did it again. We dialed it back a little bit, paying a little more attention to exactly how many responses we needed to really understand what the opinions of the public were, asking people, hey, what do you think state and local officials should talk about as they compete for your votes in the upcoming election? And we heard a lot of the same issues crop up that we did during the city council run, but it was also a lot more broad. We heard a lot more about women's health and reproductive rights. We heard a lot about development, of course, but because the state was also involved, we heard about environmental considerations. We heard about the war in Palestine, specifically we heard about Palestinian rights more than anything else in terms of that war. And it was just interesting seeing this broad swath of voter concerns when it came to the upcoming election. And especially if you phrase it that way and you're saying, hey, we're leaving out presidential concerns, we're leaving out Congress, what are you worried about locally? You get to see what people really value in their own neighborhoods. And it's always interesting just hearing from constituents.
Yeah, I definitely think it was a different slice of the political conversation than we got in, like, national polls.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay, you covered a lot, you know, development, the community agenda, housing and homelessness. You also covered blueberries.
I did cover blueberries.
You are our chief blueberry correspondent. You might actually be in the running for NPR's chief blueberry correspondent.
I would absolutely go back to the well of blueberries if it means I can go in a field and pick blueberries and then eat them for free and then be paid for it.
Science.
This was a very silly story where I went with some volunteers with the NC Cooperative Extension and learned about how they do blueberry cultivation.
Yeah. No, it's how they cultivate, you know, new varietals of blueberries. And they're scientifically sort of crafting the perfect blueberry.
And they are really good blueberries. And it was just a delight to follow people around and talk about how delicious blueberries are and put together a very silly story. And I got to interview some scientists who were just so excited about blueberries. There was this one scientist, and I will never forget how excited he was to explain to me how we as Americans found blueberries in the wild. And there was a National Geographic article that said, taming the wild blueberry. And then the next year they put out a follow-up and it was the wild blueberry tamed. And that is the start of his entire career.
Riveting. It's riveting stuff. It is tied for my first favorite public radio blueberry story with Radiolab's Planet Blueberry.
I can't believe blueberry that Earth. I didn't win.
Look, it was very close. It was very close. This is tough. These are both very good pieces.
I'm glad to be in the running with Radiolab. I'm not going to lie.
Okay, before I let you go, what are you looking forward to? And I realize that is a loaded phrase, but what are you looking forward to reporting on next year?
Oh my gosh. Well, it's going to be interesting covering the county commission with a new face on the board, Stephanie Walker replacing Jonathan Barfield. I'm interested to see how those dynamics change and how they don't change. I mean, the balance of the parties is unaffected by this election, but having a new face on the board, a very different face, much less establishment, could be a very interesting shift, and it could really put pressure on education funding. That'll be worth following. I'm also extremely interested to see how the new CEO of the New Hanover Community Endowment, Dan Winslow, operates that organization. What we've been hearing through the rumor mill is that they're going to staff up a lot at the beginning of the new year. They're going to be continuing these rolling grant cycles instead of having it all come out at once. And so I'm interested in seeing what that's going to mean for housing, what it's going to mean for education, and how exactly it's going to change the way the endowment interacts with the community, because it's been pretty separate from the community for a long time. And adding a lot more staff who might actually be currently part of the community could really change that. So very interested in following the endowment next year. And of course, I will continuously be following housing news, whether it's trying to figure out why tenants are being mistreated or exciting new developments that are going to house people who desperately need the housing.
All right. Well, I look forward to that reporting. But for now, Kelly Knoyer, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break, and then we'll be back with my colleague Nikolai Mather to round out the show. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to a year-end edition of The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. With me now to recap his year here at WHQR is my colleague Nikolai Mather. Nikolai, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me, Benjamin. We got a lot to get into.
We have a lot to get into, so let's get directly into it. Let's start geographically in Pender County, where you spent a lot of time this year.
Yes, I did spend a lot of time in Pender County. Some of the most important stories we covered in Pender County related to public schools. In the spring, we had an investigation into the firing of a very popular high school wrestling coach at Topsail High School. Pender County Schools hired a firm in Raleigh to conduct an investigation into it, which ultimately laid the blame on former coach Pete Smith. In this investigation, the firm that Pender County Schools hired alleged Smith opened up the district to health and liability issues, might have even violated Title IX by refusing to teach girls how to wrestle. You'll recall he was a little bit concerned about being implicated, his words, in something because of that.
Yeah, he did deny these allegations, saying that they were, you know, quote unquote, missing context. Again, with personnel issues in North Carolina, there's always going to be like a dense fog. So we did the best we could to sort of get through to the bare bones, at least, of what happened.
Mm-hmm. And it was very, to me, it was very interesting because the school came down so hard against him with these allegations. But overwhelmingly, the parents in the community seemed to really support Pete Smith. Now, granted, we did hear mostly from parents who turned up at school board meetings supporting Pete Smith. I'm not sure if parents who were against Pete Smith would come out in the same force or be that forthcoming with reporters. But there was a lot of interpersonal drama mixed in there. It wasn't just work drama. It was also interpersonal drama. Staying in the Topsail area, more recently, we had the death of Heather Fennell, who was a teacher at Topsail Middle School. She taught there for over 20 years. Fennell's boyfriend used to be a detective for the Pender County Sheriff's Office, and he placed a 911 call on December 4th saying that he had found her dead in their bed. At the time, they owned a house together in Hampstead. And this was really interesting, Ben, because they almost, like, Pender County Sheriff almost immediately called in the SBI to take over the investigation, likely because Lawson kind of had a conflict of interest there being a former employee of the Sheriff's Office.
Yeah, he'd also run for office against Carson Smith years ago. And yeah, to your point, this is a complicated situation. Again, we are gleaning what we can because the parties involved are kind of prohibited from really getting into too much detail about an active investigation. It is uncommon for the SBI to just step into any old death investigation. Even if this were to be ruled a homicide, most of the time local law enforcement handle this stuff. So the best explanation we have so far is that because it's sort of a former law enforcement officer involved, that's why the state's stepping in.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I mean, it wasn't just the Pender County Sheriffs who, like, recused themselves from this. DA Jason Smith, who started his tenure the literal day before this took place, also recused himself, saying he had a conflict of interest. So it seems like everybody who normally works in this sort of thing in Pender County are just hands off. The stateies are here. And I really also want to stress that last point that you talked about, Ben, like, we don't know what the circumstances of this death are quite yet. I've had a lot of people in Pender County reach out to me asking if there have been any answers related to this investigation yet. I have nothing yet. I've been touching base constantly with SBI, and they have nothing new to report since December 5th. But I really hope they do provide some answers soon because a lot of people in the community are very concerned. You know, Fennell was a very beloved teacher.
So. Yeah, and I think the most important thing here is that people, you know, It is fine to criticize law enforcement if you feel like they're moving, you know, too slowly over the course of years. But the initial investigation does take time. We've obviously both seen people jumping right to quote unquote murder, like in the comment section. And that's, good God, guys, you got to give them a little bit of time.
A little bit of time. Yes.
All right. So there was one other big story out of Pender. This was a wild story.
This is a wild story. And it also dealt with the SBI. Of course, it's Elizabeth Craver.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who was the clerk of Superior Court for Pender County, still is. I probably just spoiled the story for y'all if you haven't tuned into that. But basically, the SBI launched an investigation into Craver back in February, and she was later indicted by a jury on 4 criminal counts. Those charges mainly related to things like misuse of government property, witness intimidation, and asking her employees to campaign for her on the clock. Now, Judge Kent Harrell suspended her from office, from serving as clerk of court, due to these charges, and later had a removal hearing. So bear in mind, the story that I covered was a removal hearing. It wasn't the actual criminal hearing. That actually hasn't happened yet, and I'll get more into that in a moment. But the removal hearing basically just concerned whether she would be able to continue serving as the clerk of court for Pender County.
Right, because she's an elected official, and this is something we almost never see. It is written into state law that there's this procedure where you can have a removal hearing for powerful elected officials like sheriffs or district attorneys or clerks of court. But it is few and far between that we see one. So this was a lot of reporters, including myself, were like scrambling to sort of like flip through the law textbooks to be like, what is going on here?
And figure it out. Yeah. Anyways, essentially, Harrell heard this testimony over several days. There's a lot of courtroom drama. You'll recall that they put an air conditioning unit on trial to try and figure out if it wasn't working sufficiently.
They literally put an air conditioning unit on the stand.
It was there. Yeah, they had an SBI agent checking it every couple minutes to see if it was working or not. Essentially, I think they were trying to prove that, like, Liz Craver had purchased this AC unit with government money. And then when she heard about the SBI investigation into her using government money, like misusing government money, she tried to hide the evidence by hiding the AC unit in another building and saying it didn't work.
Right.
Which
Law and Order has nothing on this.
It is such a fine point, and it was so funny to watch unfold in real time. Anyways, all that being said, Judge Kent Harrell reinstated her after this removal hearing, and she's still the clerk of court in Pender County. Three employees ended up resigning after the hearing, and we're still actually waiting on that criminal trial. It was scheduled for June 14th, but they've been continuing and continuing and continuing it. I'm still waiting on the Conference of District Attorneys, actually, to give me updates on when the next date is, but hopefully we'll know sometime soon. Also, while we're on this subject, I want to give a special shout out to Madison Leip, formerly of the Wilmington Star News, for her excellent coverage of this trial and just Pender County in general. We met each other at this hearing, and we've been journalist buddies ever since. She just moved out of Wilmington this past week for the next big thing. And I know wherever she lands news-wise, she's going to continue to do amazing work. Maddie is a really cool person. Love you, Maddie.
It was really nice to get a chance to meet her. And I know that she cared deeply about reporting and about Pender County because, as you know, it is hard to find people who treat people in more rural areas with, you know, kind of the respect and the intelligence that they deserve.
Exactly. And she's actually got folks out there. Like, most of the time, it's just us gnarly transplants covering rural politics. So to have someone with that background is so invaluable. Anyways, moving on, we got another big county that I spent a lot of time in this past year, Brunswick County.
That's right. I feel like you've done almost nothing but drive back and forth between Brunswick County.
Yeah. Yeah. That bridge is my best friend. But to be fair, it was a lot of important things going on down there. We had the proposed tax hike in Leland back in April. God, that feels like years ago. Which y'all will recall started out as a 70% increase and then passed at 17%. Folks were still very unhappy with any level of tax increase. Here's J.R. Hildreth, who came out for a rally against the town council's increase.
We have to fight it and say, we're not going to take it.
They're not going to take it.
They're not going to take it. I do recall them holding a smartphone up to the microphone and playing the classic anthem, we're not going to take it. That's one of my favorites.
I love Brunswick County politics. Anyways, they later got Representative Frank Eiler to introduce a bill to change Leland's charter, which would allow recall elections since Leland's town council members aren't up for re-election until 2025 and 2027. So I'm still not too clear about how that bill is going. You know that oftentimes General Assembly bills just kind of stall out and wait for a bit.
And then they come back the next year.
So I'll keep an eye on that, though. We also had, obviously, potential tropical cyclone number 8, which devastated Carolina Beach and southern Brunswick County. It killed at least one person in Brunswick County. It stranded thousands of people, including actually Rachel Keith's husband for a little while. And it goes without saying, damaged most of the roads in that area of the county. It's something that a lot of Brunswick County residents are still recovering from and will be recovering from over the next couple years. And then also there was the election in Brunswick County. Republicans and Democrats alike told us that it would be one of the most contested elections in memory, particularly for county commission, which historically has been a fairly easy win for Republicans. And I thought it was interesting because Republican incumbent commissioners really avoided candidate forums during election season. Shelley Allen from Brunswick County Dems told WHQR it was because they didn't want to be held accountable for their approach towards development in the county. They didn't want voters to like be asking them big questions about that. But I was surprised when I got up with Commissioner Mike Forte because he told me it was because the election was getting way too heated.
Yeah, this is a Republican commissioner, Mike Forte.
I'm getting yelled at, literally spit on, physically assaulted. It's unreal. This is the nastiest election I have ever seen.
I thought it was interesting because much has been made over Republican scare tactics used against Democrats in Brunswick County over the past couple months. You know, Allen also told WHQR that Republicans were unfairly trying to intimidate canvassers or, you know, mess with their freedom of speech. But what Forte described to me was like a woman came up to him in the grocery store and was like, "Are you a commissioner?" And he was like, "Yes." And then like spat on him and said that she hated him. So it really was a very heated election for both sides, it sounds like to me. But ultimately, all three incumbents won their elections for county commissioner. So still very, very close election. I recall that Josh Stein actually won that county, which I was super surprised to see.
Yeah. And we'll have links on the show page to some of the like really unexpected election voter turnout dynamics. It was really weird. But I want to pivot before we leave Brunswick County to, I think, your favorite story, maybe my favorite story from Brunswick County this year.
It's your favorite story, too?
Oh, my gosh. This was a good story.
Thank you so much. Well, it's definitely my favorite story, honestly. It's a lot more human interest. It was about the Brunswick County Drag Drive, which is the first drag show I can find any record of in Brunswick County. Princess Malaysia Kay, the performer who organized this event, told me that even though there was a bit of backlash to the event, they still saw an overwhelming amount of support from the county.
And anytime somebody says anything derogatory online, the owner and the business and everybody who supports, you know, us has been right there helping us and not attacking other people, but defending us. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I loved covering the story in part because I know most of the girls from the scene here in Wilmington. Shout out Karma. We missed you at dinner this month, girl. But also because it showed how this rural community is changing. And also, at the same time, not changing at all, you know, changing in that people are more likely and more willing to openly support the LGBTQ community, but not changing because gay people and trans people have been living and working in Brunswick County for decades, and they're not going anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is definitely showing the changing face of Brunswick County. There will always be people who don't like change for whatever reason, but I thought that hearing firsthand from people about, you know, what's that like? And also hearing that the locals have their back, like that was really encouraging.
That was really encouraging. And it was strange to me, too, because I was reporting on this when we were fully in the swing of election season.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody that I spoke to at that event was a Republican. I mean, not the performers. I didn't ask them about their politics, but the owners are apparently Republican. Most of the people in the audience were Republicans. I thought that was fascinating.
Thanks for joining us today. Before I let you go, anything you're looking forward to in 2025 on your reporting beats?
Oh, geez. I am looking forward to doing more development stories. I think that those are just going to get more and more urgent, especially, I mean, with just this past hurricane season that we've had, you know, we've seen a lot of people rallying under the flag of stopping overdevelopment. A lot of people see it as directly connected to more drastic environmental impacts on our coastal communities. So I'm really looking forward to getting into that. I'm really looking forward to getting into the future of politics, especially in Brunswick County. I think it's changing dramatically. And yeah, I guess I'm looking forward to crossing that bridge a couple more times.
All right. Well, I look forward to all of that, Nikolai. But for now, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Benjamin.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Newsroom. Thanks to my colleagues, Rachel Keith, Aliyah McConnell, Kelly Knoyer, and Nikolai Mather for joining me today. And of course, to WHQR's Ken Campbell for help with all things technical. If you missed any part of the program, you can find it at WHQR.org or wherever you find podcasts. And if you have comments, concerns, or just an idea for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@WHQR.org. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom, but until then, happy holidays and happy new year.